You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm flying solo again today as my co-host, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox, is tending with one of her clients. Each week, we will bring you we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we will continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is finding your focus, mastering distraction, and getting the right things done. And that's the key, is getting the right things done, because I think what our guest is going to talk about is that maybe a lot of us are getting things done, but is it really the right thing? Now, our guest today is Peter Bregman. Peter is the CEO of Bregman Partners, a global management consultancy company where he is the advisor to CEOs as well as their top management teams on leadership and workplace issues. He has appeared on CNN and PBS and writes for PsychologyToday.com, FastCompany.com, and Forbes.com. He is a regular contributor to WNYC Radio, which is the New York NPR affiliate. Peter is one of Harvard Business Review's most popular online columnists, and he has written a new book entitled 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done, which, as I've said, is the topic of our show today. Peter, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's been a pleasure reading your book. Now, I have not finished it, I must confess, which probably means that I didn't manage my time quite well enough to be able to read it all, but I will finish it, and I am enjoying it up to this point. One of the first things that I got from it was the concept of distraction. You know, the fact that, at least for me anyway, I just have so many different distractions. There is constantly something going on. So I guess let's start with, why is it more important than ever that we master our distraction?
You know, when I entered the workforce and sort of left college and went into the world close to 25 years ago now, it was a completely different world. I mean, we didn't have email. I wrote my thesis on a group computer in a computer lab. I didn't have a computer. I went into college with a typewriter. There's this great quote. I may be able to find it. I'm just going to talk about distractions. I'm going to look for it quickly on my computer, because my wife had sent it to me by Carl Jung. And he talked about the new technology and the fact that the new technology that was coming out, this was, 80 years ago or so, or 100 years ago, the new technology that was coming out was making it much harder for people to be themselves and be, this is what happens when you try to do two things at once. I was looking for the quote. He says, here it is. Let me read this quote to you. It's a, reforms by advances, that is by new methods or gadgets, of course are impressive at first, but in the long run they are dubious, and in any case dearly paid for. They by no means increase the contentment or happiness of people on the whole. Mostly they are deceptive sweetenings of existence, like speedier communications. Side note here, he's talking about the speedier communication called the telephone. speedier communications, which unpleasantly accelerate the tempo of life and leave us with less time than ever before. Omnis festinatio ex parte diablo est. All haste is of the devil, as the old masters used to say. So here's Carl Jung talking maybe 100 years ago about the dangers of the speediness of technology like a telephone. And we, in the last 20 years, have sped that up to an unrecognizable tempo. I mean, when you think about texting and email and Skype and Twitter and, you know, the hundreds of thousands of millions of pieces of information that have the capacity to flow to us at any given moment. And as a species, we haven't actually adjusted to how to manage that. So, you know, I think to myself so often, I have three children, and I think to myself so often, the how difficult it must be to be a child in an era where they have to share their time with our iPhones and Blackberries, and we're right in front of them, and at the same time, we're, you know, we're with our children, we're holding their hands. I can't tell you, I live in New York City, and I walk by how often I see somebody with a child in one hand and a Blackberry in the other, and the child is growing up with the experience of being physically connected to an inattentive adult, and what that means for us. It's just never been so easy to be distracted by things that ultimately, you know, as Carl Jung said, don't particularly enhance our lives.
Well, and I couldn't agree more. And with some of the work that we do with young people, more and more we're hearing, as we talk to some of the teenagers that we're taking to a program or something, you know, that part of the acting out that they've done was they were just trying to get their parents' attention.
Right.
So isn't that amazing, right, that at the same time in which you're talking about the fact that they're physically connected but yet not mentally connected with them, and now, you know, we're dealing with children that are acting out saying, I'm doing this just to get their attention. I think you're really onto something here.
And I think it's so much worse of a message to be physically present but mentally and emotionally absent than if you were just physically not there. You know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, there was a lot of conversation about latchkey kids and what it was like to grow up when you have to let yourself in to your house yourself and your parents aren't there. However challenging that was for parents and for children in the 70s, it's much worse when your parents are in the room and just ignoring you. And I'm not speaking from some, you know, proselytizing moral figure, you know, telling everybody what to do because I do all this stuff perfectly. I struggle with this tremendously. It's why I wrote the book. I mean, with three children and running a business and writing, and it's very difficult to manage that balance because it is so tempting, so deliciously tempting to see whether a new email has come in or not.
Well, and at the same time, I think that it's working both ways, because that's the same way that the kids are seeing it. So now we have situations to where with our kids, as a parent, at the time in which we believe it's time to talk to them, and we're trying to talk to them, and they're like, well, hang on just a moment, because Bobby's texting me right now, and this is really urgent, and I got to get back to him. You know, which,
yeah, that's so insightful and so completely true. And it's, you know, you remember the Cat Stevens song, long, you know, Silver Spoon, and it everything takes a cycle, and suddenly we're wanting their attention and we can't get their attention. And you know, I think as parents, we live with a certain indignation that how, you know, we're their parents, how could they be ignoring us like this? And yet, of course, you know, this is who they're learning it from.
Right. And I know that, I mean, we're all busy. And I think that's one of the key components whenever you ask somebody something, you know, so how are you doing? What are you doing? Oh, I'm busy. Well, what do we need to do differently so that we can live lives that are fulfilling rather than just busy?
Right. It's exactly right. And that's where it's so easy to get caught, because it is, on a very thin, superficial level, so tempting to be busy, to have long to-do lists and just cross things off those to-do lists and feel like we've accomplished a lot. only to end a week or a month or a year to realize that the things that were most important for us to get done, we never got done.
Right.
And there's reasons why we don't do those things. We don't do those things because they're important. So unless we're very specifically intentional about doing the things that are most important to us, those are the things that will fall through the cracks.
Right. And if one of those things is your children that didn't get attention, you know, we're going to have that same type of problem. We're going to now plan or set up a situation with the next generation that maybe they weren't that important, or maybe they need to if they're going to try to mimic what we're doing, again, like we said with the, you know, the old, you know, the song, Cats in the Cradle, you know, they're going to now start mimicking it and they're going to pass it on to another generation.
So, that's exactly right.
So now, when I was reading the book, and I noticed right from the start, you discuss the Find Me button for life. You know, can you explain a little bit, you know, kind of to the audience, I mean, what this is and the role it plays in all of us getting back on track to find our focus so that we're putting the most important things first?
You know, most of these experiences, most of what I write in the book comes from my own failings and challenges that I face, and I started a company in the late 90s in order to grow to be a nice big company, and I achieved everything that I wanted to achieve in terms of my business plan, in terms of, you know, what I had set out to do. I had built it. We had, you know, offices in several places around the country and the world. We had, you know, 80 to 100 consultants who were doing work in various projects, and I had hit my financial figures every year, and I had, you know, was kind of moving in the direction that I was moving, and I wasn't doing it at the expense of my family life. I was, during that time, I got married, I had my first child, and so from the outside, you could look at it and say, well, this is great. He's a high achiever. He's doing everything he wants to do. It's working. There's some combination of skill and talent and luck, and it all seems to be working. But, you know, I would go into therapy sessions, and I would have these dreams of being underneath a car turning screws. And these were horror dreams to me. I'm from New York City. My first car I bought when I was 35 years old. I've never been underneath a car in my life, which is evidenced by the fact that I thought there were screws underneath the car, apparently. I've been told there's other things, but not screws. So this is like my nightmare. And yet, it's supposed to not be my nightmare. It's supposed to be everything that I planned out, because it was. And I had this experience, this is a metaphor of the Find Me button, where I was in New York, and I had pressed Google Maps, the Google Earth application, and it I opened up Google Earth, and I was in, according to Google Earth, I was in Savannah, Georgia, which is where I must have been when I last used the, you know, my iPhone and the Google Earth app, and so there's a little circular, what I call the Find Me button. It's the circular locator. And it's the GPS, and you press that button on the screen, and you shoot up in the air, and you see a circling, not physically, obviously, but you see a circling Earth, and then slowly they bring you back down to Earth, to your state, to your city, eventually to your street and your doorstep. And I felt like, for me, what I needed to do was press that Find Me button for my life and kind of get up in the air and get a bird's eye view and say, am I doing what I'm meant to be doing? Am I leveraging my talents in the best way? Am I using my strengths and actually even my weaknesses? And am I following my passions? Am I leveraging the ways in which I'm different? Am I in my sweet spot of how I could be most happy and most effective and most productive and contribute to myself and my family and the world? And I needed to kind of press that Find Me button and then lower myself back to that place that's just the right fit for me, where I could do all those things, be happy and productive. And so that's sort of what the first part of 18 Minutes, the book, is about, is pressing that Find Me button and figuring out where is it that you should be. Most often, it's not that far from where you are. We have a really great natural ability to find ourselves in situations that tend to fit pretty well. But there's often a few modifications we can make that really makes the difference. And that's what ended up happening for me.
Okay, so it, what I'm getting then is that with the Find Me button, you know, if you press it and, like you said, you're in New York and it says that you're in Savannah, Georgia, you're probably pretty far off the track.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And you know, but it doesn't have to be that far off the track, meaning for me, you know, I continued to consult. I tried a whole bunch of other things, and I talk about this in 18 minutes. I applied to rabbinical school. I went to acting classes. I thought about becoming a doctor. I played around with a hedge fund. I mean, I tried all these other things. But what it turned out is that I came back to consulting. It's what I really, really love to do. But running a consulting company is very, very different than being a consultant. It's the opposite, actually. Right. I mean, as someone running a consulting company, I've got to manage a group of people. I have to create methodology that I can replicate across 80 different consultants. So I couldn't really be as creative as I like to be. You know, when I'm as a consultant, what I love is the creativity piece. It's the innovation. It's looking at a problem and solving it uniquely for that particular problem. It's all of that stuff, and that you have a harder time doing when you have 80 people that need to maintain quality of a certain methodology. So for me, that became a great lesson in saying I'm not that far, but the little shift from being an independent consultant to running a consulting company makes all the difference.
Yeah, and in fact, you touched on something, I can't think of the name of his book now, but anyway, Michael Gerber touches on that quite a bit.
The E-Myth.
Yeah, the E-Myth, exactly. And, yeah. And he touches on the fact that so many of us are so good and so passionate at what it is that we do, and we do that well, and then we form a company, and we now are in a position of setting up a system to manage people to do what it is that we were doing that we had such passion for. We're now not doing that anymore. And I think you bring up a great point. I think so many of us kind of miss that when we try to expand our business, that we're not really doing the specific thing that we were most passionate about, which also brings me to something else that you had in the book, and I really liked it. I'd love for you to talk about it, and that is, you know, how can we put ourselves back in the position to where we are doing the thing that we are most successful at, that we are most powerful at, that we are most charismatic at, and most effective at, to get us back to that point and away from what some of us get kind of drawn into, where we're trying to spend too much time fixing our weaknesses.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell a quick story, which is that I was at lunch with a friend of mine. He's a very, very wealthy gentleman. He's given away over $500 million, so he's got a lot of money. And we were at lunch, and he ordered the Caesar salad with shrimp. And he said, but, you know, instead of shrimp, if you don't mind, I'd like salmon. And the waiter said, that's fine. That's no problem at all. It'll be an extra dollar, right? Remember, this man given away $500 million. It's an extra dollar. And he pauses for a minute, and he says, you know what? Forget it. That's okay. I'll just have the shrimp. And I said to him, listen, I know you're taking me to lunch. Let me buy you the difference between the shrimp and the salmon. Let it be my dollar again. You deserve. You've given away so much of your money. You deserve to have exactly what you want. And he said, you know what? It's not worth it. It's not. Forget it. I'm fine with the shrimp. It's not worth your money. And I'm thinking to myself, on the one hand, like, this guy's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got a problem. He's got a dysfunction. He should see a therapist. But you look at it another way, and you realize, you know, actually, this is the secret to his success. This guy made all of his money as investing in undervalued real estate. What he does is he cannot stand to spend a dollar when it's not bringing $5 worth of value. And so you could look at that and say, you know, he should spend years trying to figure it out so that he could spend his money more freely so he could enjoy it. But to him, he made a very quick calculation in his head. It's not worth the trade-off. He doesn't have a problem with that. Fixing that quote-unquote weakness would not only make him less happy, but it would hurt his success. Whereas allowing himself to just be himself, to not have to constantly fix himself, allows him, but to put himself in a situation in which that particular characteristic or personality trait is precisely the one he needs in order to make himself successful. That's the perfect situation to be in. Don't fix yourself and then do something where you have to constantly work at thinking about money differently. Just recognize that that's who you are and put yourself in a situation where the way you think about money in that way helps you to be successful.
Well, I got to tell you, I absolutely love that story, and I think it really drives the point home. And I think a lot of us can look at that as is that we come as a package, you know, and part of that package that has helped get us successful may have these things that other people would think are quirky. I think that's great. I love the fact that you're getting that message out, you know, both in the book and here on the air.
Thanks.
So now, you know, obviously, the first part of the book is 18 minutes. How did you come to 18 minutes? I mean, why couldn't it have been 10, 20, 30?
You know, for me, it was trial and error. I break up 18 minutes throughout the day. So it's 5 minutes in the morning, 1 minute each hour, and then 5 minutes in the evening. And the way it works for me is I spent, first of all, let me back up for 1 second and talk about the to-do list that I use, because it's a different kind of to-do list than other people. And this all stems from a basic idea. And my basic idea is that in my view, the greatest myth perpetuated by people who try to teach time management is that you can get it all done. Mm-hmm. And I ultimately think that's a setup. It's a mistake and it's a setup. You can't get it all done. There is just too much to do and it is never ending. Everybody wants your attention. There's so many reasons why you're going to be stretched in a multiple set of directions that if you really try to get it all done, and what a lot of time management does is just follow my system, my process, organize your work in a certain way, and you'll be able to get it all done. And I think thinking that way ends up leading us to have the wrong things fall through the cracks. We end up trying to get it all done, not getting the things that are most important to us done, and then we end our day and our year feeling unsatisfied. So my starting off premise is that you can't get it all done. Given that, that puts us in a wonderful situation to have to make choices. And to make those choices intentionally and strategically up front is much more effective than having those choices made for us based on happenstance and the fact that we've run out of time before we've done the thing that we felt was most important. So I start with that premise. The next thing that I do is I say, okay, so if I'm not going to get everything done, what am I going to get done? I need to be strategic. So my to-do list is what I call the six-box to-do list, and you can download a version of this. It's actually quite simple, but if you want to download a version, you find it on my website on the right-hand side. You can get resources along with 18 minutes, and the six-box to-do list is one of the resources that are available. Website's my name, peterbregman.com. And the six-box to-do list has five boxes that represent five of the top areas that you want to focus on for the year. And then my sixth box, I label the other 5%. So at the beginning of every year, I decide what are five things that are most important to me to get done. For me, it's focusing on doing great work with my current clients. It's growing the business. It's speaking and writing about my ideas. It's more creative and inventive writing. And it's nurturing myself and my family. Those are my five things. And the reason that it's, you know, February, and I know what they are, and I set them up January, because every single day I look at those, because each one of five boxes is devoted to one of those things. And every task that I have to accomplish has to fit in one of those boxes, or it goes in the other 5% box. When I first started keeping a to-do list like this, the only box I could fill was the other 5%. Everything I was doing were these busy work that was outside the areas that I most wanted to focus on. But seeing that, very quickly I was able to change it. So within not very many days, my tasks and my to-dos started to shift. And I started to have tasks more focused on those areas that are most important to me. So that's where I'm starting. Now the 18 minutes, which was your question. Sorry, that was
right.
A very long answer.
No problem.
So now in the morning I spend 5 minutes, and I take this six-box to-do list, and I look at what are the most important things to get done today. These are my first 5 minutes of my day before I check my email, before anything else. If you could do it before your children wake up, if you could do it in the morning, you know, my wife and I are in the habit now of getting up as much as we can figure it, about 20 to 30 minutes earlier than our kids, so that we could read and journal and meditate and do some stuff that helps to ground and center us. So my 5 minutes can fit in here. What are the most important things that I can get done today? And then I move those things from my six-box to-do list to my calendar. There's a tremendous amount of evidence that points to the fact that if you decide when and where you're going to get something done, you'll get it done. And if you don't, you probably won't. They asked women to do a breast cancer check sometime in the next 30 days. 53% of them did it. Then they said, tell me when and where you're going to do it. 100% of them did it. They asked a group of people to write an essay sometime before in the next 24 hours. 33% of them did it. Tell me when and where you're going to write it. 75% of them did it. There's magic in moving things from your to-do list to your calendar. The other advantage is that your calendar is limited, and so you're not going to fit everything in, and you're going to have to make choices about what's most important and what's less important. So those are my first 5 minutes of my day. Then I set my watch to beep every hour, and on that hour I take a deep breath and I ask myself two questions. Am I doing what I most need to be doing right now? And am I being who I most want to be right now? Those are the two questions that I ask myself. And I interrupt myself every hour for just a minute, which some people think is a lot, but the truth is I can work the other 59 minutes. So this is just 1 minute every hour. And asking myself that question helps me move from the distractions that got me off track to what I need to be focusing on in that moment. So that's really, really helpful little breaks in time to make sure that I'm doing what I need to be doing. And then my final 5 minutes, I look at what worked, what didn't work for the day, what I want to change, and then I wrap up and tie up loose ends. I look at, you know, is there anyone I need to thank or to update or to share information with? It's a way of, again, making sure that important things don't fall through the cracks. And that's how I form my 18 minutes, 1 minute each hour, 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the evening.
I like it. Now, when you're talking about those five boxes, what about projects that you know are going to, you know, take certainly longer than that day? You know, if you have something that you know is something that maybe is going to be drawn out over the next couple of weeks, how do you control yourself from the standpoint of getting as much done as you need and not feeling like you didn't complete it?
Well, so there I break it up into chunks. There I'll say, you know, this I have to write, you know, over the next 6 months I have to write the proposal for my next book. So how am I going to do that? What am I going to do? Well, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by writing the outline. So the piece of work that I really need to do today might be to just frame what is the focus. That was my work today. It's going to take an hour to kind of look through some stuff and some other things that I've written. So I sort of can position this for today, but I know that there's lots of other pieces to pulling that together and writing the proposal for that next book. So I'm going to have to, you know, decide what those pieces are, which I could do on a separate piece of paper, and then begin to look at those pieces and schedule those into my calendar.
Well, that's good. And we also just learned that Peter's going to have a new book coming out in about 6 months.
If I write the proposal, which I will do, and then if someone buys it, which is always a little more questionable, but let's hope. And then, you know, I mean, the publishing industry is crazy, so I will have the book proposal out. I can have the book finished in 6 months, and it won't come out for another month and another 18 months. But yes, please God, hopefully my next book will come out.
There we go. All right, we're going to take a break. We're talking with Peter Bregman. The book is 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. We will be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today, Peter Bregman, and we're talking about finding your focus, mastering distraction, and getting the right things done. Now, Peter, we were talking a little bit about your five boxes for 95% of the things that you're going to do. Being as you've done that for a while now, I mean, is there particular problems? I mean, the things maybe that you did to help kind of get the bugs out? Because, I mean, you know, besides maybe, you know, procrastination, you know, what are some of the problems that you can run into, or that some of us that may try this may run into, and the things that we can do to get around it?
You know, one of the things is that we try to pack too much in. I know that's one of the problems that I have. I even using my calendar, I try to pack too much in. And that's a problem, because then I end up late everywhere, or I end up doing too much and not prepared for the next meeting. And one of the things that I really try to do and I talk about, and my wife is much better at this than I am, is building in transition time. I'll give you an example. We were going to a dinner that started at 7 o'clock, and we were driving there, and it was 6 o'clock, and my wife turned to me and said, like, I'm really stressed. You know, we're so late. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, it's like, it's 6 o'clock. The dinner doesn't start till 7 o'clock. Like, we're not late. We're an hour early. And we were actually driving from upstate New York into New York City. So it was a three-hour drive. She said, you know, but, you know, we're 3 hours away. We're going to be 2 hours late. I mean, we're 3 hours away. And I said, you know, but we're not late yet, right? It's 6 o'clock now. We're not late until it's 7 o'clock. Right now, we're an hour early. There's no reason to stress. Which, of course, you can imagine how it exasperates her. Here's how she thinks. She thinks, okay, we have to be at this dinner at 7. It's going to take 3 hours. That means we should leave at 3, but that doesn't give us time in New York to change and shower and make sure the kids are with the babysitter. So we should really leave at 2. If we're going to leave at 2, though, that means we need to finish eating by around 1 to make sure that we pack the car, which means that the kids have to come in from skiing at 12, which means if they're going to get their full 3 hours of skiing, and at least in the morning, we got to get them out by 9, which means we have to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning in order to really give them enough time to eat breakfast and get out by 9. Which means if we're going to get them up at 7 in the morning and we want them to get a full night of sleep, they really need to be asleep by 10, which means we need to be asleep by 11, which means we need to have finished that movie by 9, which means we have to have dinner by 6. And I'm looking at her, and it's the day before, mid-afternoon, and I say, you know, look, we're already late for the dinner tomorrow night. and the truth is, the way she thinks about it is a much better way to think about it than the way I think about it. You count your way back and you build in transition time. We tend to, you know, book meetings or you know, social events or whatever it is back to back, and it's impossible. It's impossible to even change your frame of mind, your head, about what is it that I'm doing and what am I focused on. So to build 15-minute, half-hour windows between things, to build in downtime that allows us to just get our heads on straight and prepare for the next thing that we're going to do. I am terrible at doing this, and yet I really strongly believe it's important enough that we should put it in our calendars. Because if you're really able to get your head straight, you could cut something that's going to take an hour into half an hour anyway, and if you spent 15 minutes getting your head straight about it, you saved 15 minutes right there. So there's no question that it's good for time, but it's also good for our enjoyment.
Oh, yeah.
You know, of the situation. And I would say that the other thing related to that is this myth of multitasking. It's a terrible damage. We cannot do it. We know a tremendous amount about the science of how our brains work, and our brains cannot do this. And, in fact, let me do an experiment with you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
This will be fun. Count from 1 to 10 as fast as you can, out loud.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay, you probably could have even done that faster. But now, go on the alphabet from A to J as fast as you can.
A, B, C, D, E, F, D, A, B, C, E, F, G, H, I, J.
Great. So that those were both maybe 2 seconds. Now try this. A1, B2, C3, and do that to J in 10.
Okay. A1, B2, 3C, 4D, 5E, 6F, 7G, 8HIJ.
Okay, so that's my point. Oh. So first of all, part of the point is you even switched in the middle from letters to numbers because it's really, really hard. And second, look, if it takes 2 seconds to go 1 to 10, 2 seconds to go A to J, if multitasking were useful, we should at least be able to do both of them together in 4 seconds. If multitasking were really useful and we can get more done by multitasking, maybe we could do that in 3 seconds because we're doing them at the same time. But the truth is it takes 20 seconds. You know, it takes 10 times as long if you try to do them at the same time because your brain is switching very quickly from one mode to the other. You're switching from numbers to letters. And when you're switching, you lose time in the switching. So we don't multitask. We switch task. And when we switch task, we lose valuable times as we're moving from our email to the phone call to the magazine that we were reading, or if you try to watch television and do work at the same time, forget it. It's going to take you 20 times as long to get something accomplished as it would if you just did one and then just did the other. So I think, you know, both building transition time in and recognizing the myth of multitasking and doing our best to do one thing at a time makes a tremendous difference.
Well, I think that's a great point. You know, I certainly felt it. I mean, just as I was trying to essentially do two things at once, I was bogging down and bogging down. Now, when you just mentioned in regards to, you know, doing a lot of, we're still doing a lot of things, but we're doing them kind of one at a time. I noticed in the book that you said something in regards to, you know, that interruption helps us master our time and keeps us focused. And I think obviously you're referring to your 1 minute interruption. You know, I would tend to argue it just the opposite, you know, thinking that I get on a roll and I'm on something and then, you know, the phone rings. And so I have to look at it to see if it's the school calling about something with the kids. So I know I have to break away to check it, or the office calls, or somebody comes in, or there's a new case and it breaks my train of thought. To me, I feel like, by the end of the day, whatever those things were that I started, I didn't get to them because of so many different interruptions. So I'll find myself trying to, you know, shut the door and kind of get away from everybody and say, God, just give me 2 hours uninterrupted so I can get this finished. So
right.
Explain kind of why interruptions can be good, I guess, to help us master our time.
Well, those kinds of interruptions, the interruptions where you end up, here's the interruption that's not useful, ready? Someone sends me an email, I'm writing a piece, someone sends me an email, I hear the email ding, I look at the email, it's a really funny YouTube video, I go onto YouTube, I watch the video, I laugh, that's really fun. Then I see that there's 4 others like it, so I kind of check out those videos. Then one of the videos has something to do with food, and I realize I'm kind of hungry, so then I go into the kitchen and I eat some food, and while I'm eating some food, I listen to the radio, and then as I'm listening to NPR or LA Talk Radio, so then it reminds me of something, and then I go to do that thing. And suddenly, like, I'm half finished everything that I'm doing, and I don't actually complete anything that I'm doing, and I'm moving from one distraction to another. So that's not useful. But here's what those 1 minute interruptions can do. 1 minute an hour, which is nothing, beeps. I take a deep breath, and I realize, oh my gosh, I'm on YouTube right now. Is this really the best use of my time? Is this really what I want to be doing right now? Or should I realize that I've been seduced by one of the many distractions that are available to seduce me, and now I should go back to doing the thing that's actually most important to me. If I'm in the middle of doing something that's really important, like writing that piece, and my watch beeps and I take a deep breath, and I say, is this the best thing? Am I using my time most effectively right now? I could say, yeah, you know, it's going really well. This is great. And then I turn off the beep, and I go right back to doing the work that I need to do. So the interruption doesn't take me away from what I need to do, but it allows me to be intentional about saying, to catch me in the act of either doing the thing that's most important for me to be doing at any given moment or to not. I've been distracted, by the way. Sometimes I'll be working and one of my children will come into the office and start talking to me and the watch will beep and I'll take a deep breath. And whereas beforehand I was a little annoyed because I'm trying to get some work and they've come in and they're interrupting me and I'm trying to get my work done, but the watch beeps and I take a deep breath and I say, you know what? Right now, the most important thing I could be doing is listening to Isabel or Sophia or Daniel and focusing on them. And so it actually helps me to focus on the thing that's right in front of me that I need to be doing and I should be doing instead of worrying about the 20 other things that I need to do. So in that way, the interruption just helps us to be conscious and intentional about what we're doing.
I think that makes perfect sense. Now, how do you determine, I know you mentioned in the book there's an ignore list. I mean, with so much technology, you know, emails, text, tweet, Facebook, you know, 24-hour news, I mean, how do you determine what is really important and what can go on the ignore list? Now, I know obviously the YouTube video of humor and stuff like that. Yeah, we know when we do that, yeah, this probably isn't, you know, the best use of my time. But for those of us, again, at you as a consultant, you know, what if the tweet is from, you know, one of your bigger clients, you know, or the email asks a question of you, you know, as a consultant, you know, I need to make a particular decision. Now, their urgency has now become your urgency. How do you fit that in?
Great question. And I do my best to schedule in things like email, so I'm not checking it obsessively. I'll you know, give 30 minutes in the morning, 30 minutes in the afternoon, 30 minutes in the evening kind of thing to try to just go, and I make it a little bit of a game for myself. I try as fast as I can to go through as much as I can in terms of the email. And, you know, I triage. There's some email. It's very hard for me. This is one of the hardest things. I still have a hard time with it. If someone takes the time to email me, it's very hard for me to decide, you know what, I have so much to do right now. I don't have the time. Like, I could appreciate what they said. I allow it to touch me. I take that time. But do I have the time to respond to every email? I find it obnoxious to answer, no, I don't have time to respond to every email. And yet, I found that that's the kind of decision that I have to make if I'm going to get my most important things done, that I can't, you know, devote time to everything that everybody needs me to devote time to. I've rarely had almost never had a client request that requires that I get to someone instantaneously. I just think that sometimes that's the expectation, and if you do that all the time, you will be in a never-ending battle with yourself to try to make yourself fully available to everybody all the time, and it will work to your disadvantage and to the disadvantage of your family and ultimately your work, that you want to be more judicious about when you're doing what. So I don't think that there's any email that comes in, for the most part, that can't wait a couple of hours to be responded to. So I find that if you break that up, you're not going to be interrupted each time. You're going to get good work done, which ultimately is more valuable to people. And you, you know, you won't be kind of distracted or thrown around at the whim of whatever technological device has contacted you at that moment.
Well, speaking of emails, we have one that's coming across right now, and this one reads, I have been a child psychologist in Arizona for 20 years, and it is becoming increasingly more difficult to treat my teenage patients. Their attention span is close to nil. Parents complain that they are brilliant at video games, but they lack the focus to sit still and read a book, do their homework, or even hold a conversation at the dinner table. So they come to me to, quote, fix it. I could truly use a few new techniques in my toolbox and would love your comments on how your book could be applied to young people.
You know, it's a great email and not an easy answer. It's hard because the distractions are so strong. So, you know, I think it's in terms of therapy, there's some like behavioral cognitive therapy type stuff that needs to go on, just in terms of learning the skills of working productively versus the multitasking. So the first thing is, I think there's lots of really compelling research that for teenagers, you know, to the extent that they listen to things like research, it's worth at least sharing it because it goes in their head somewhere. And if they don't necessarily live by it, they begin to notice in their own behavior, oh, wow, look at that. I just tried to watch TV and write this report, and I've tried to do it for the last 40 minutes, and I haven't gotten anywhere. And, oh, yeah, that's right. My therapist told me this stuff doesn't work. So it's giving them both a language and an awareness of those things don't work. The second is, I think it's really useful to find areas where that kind of focus exists for them. So, for example, you know, my daughter, Isabel, absolutely loves reading. And whereas it might be hard to get her to focus on some things, it's almost impossible to stop her from focusing on the reading. She won't hear anything that you say. And I think it's useful to look at those and then be able to leverage those strengths, to be able to sort of talk to them a little bit about what are those areas where they really don't want to be interrupted. They don't want to be interrupted by what someone's doing or by mm-hmm. a need that someone else has because they're so focused on the thing that they're doing. Maybe, by the way, that thing is video games. Right. Maybe that thing is I'm totally focused on video games. And then I think it's useful to look at what is it about video games that is so fun and enticing and engaging, and to see if they could find those kinds of game-like characteristics in the parts of life that are less fun and less game-like. I mean, this is a totally silly example, but when I say to my kids, let's go brush our teeth, they're just going to sit there. If I say, who could get to the bathroom first, they're tripping over each other to try to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's ways to build life around any age child that makes it kind of more on their level exciting and fun and engaging. And I think as adults, we have to remember that just telling people, I have to remember this. I'm not, again, speaking like a guru on high. I have to remind myself of this all the time. I'm looking at a picture of my three kids right now, and I have to constantly remind myself that they're not adults, mm-hmm. that they can't, I can't just really fully reason with them, and that they, you know, I could share with them research, I could share things with them so that they can, it can enter their frame of awareness. And then I have to create an environment that makes it more likely that they'll do the kinds of things that is in their best interest. You know, given left to our own devices, we often tend to do things that are not in our best interest. And if you ever wonder about that, just go to a buffet. You go to a buffet, and there's like a million things to eat. And here's the problem. The problem is what you want to eat in the moment is different than what you want to have eaten at the end of the day.
Exactly.
So it's very, very hard not to overeat, not to eat the wrong things, not to... And so what do? You create an environment that's going to make it more likely you'll make the right choices. How I solve that problem is I go to a buffet with a salad plate. And I tell myself I could fill up my salad plate with whatever I want to fill it up with, but that's it. That's all I get.
Mm-hmm.
So I constrict my environment. It's actually very similar to what I suggest people do with a calendar. You constrict your calendar in such a way that it becomes clear that you only have so much space in your day. You only have so much space in your stomach. And then you force choices upon yourself that will make you more effective, that will help you to eat better, that will help you to spend your time where it matters most. So if you create an environment that's more effective for a teenager. For example, one piece of advice I would give to a parent is, and a lot of people might say this is impossible to get done, but I know for myself that if I bring my iPad into the bedroom, I'm going to end up doing stuff that I don't want to do. I'm going to end up checking email too late at night. I'm going to end up watching something I don't want to watch. And the best way to do it is to keep it out of my bedroom. So, you know, if there are not electronic-free spaces in your house, it's going to be much harder to gain your kids' attention. If you're willing to put the computer in a place where they aren't always, so that there are spaces where that won't naturally, you know, if you literally leave your phone somewhere, if you physically create an environment that makes it more likely that the teenager will do what you want them to do and what you know is in their best interest, you have a better shot at getting them
there. Well, and you're absolutely right, and there's plenty of other reasons why the electronic computers and such should be in common areas anyway, but we'll have to discuss that
Absolutely.
Another time. And to add one more thing to that is we talked about it when we first started the show, and that was in regard to this question, if the parents are complaining about this, they might look to themselves and see what are they patterning for these children that now have no time for them or can't carry on a conversation with them. They need to look at what they've patterned as well. You know,
thank you for that, because I thought of mentioning that and I didn't mention, but it is so absolutely true, and I myself am guilty of this. It is so true that it is so easy to expect something of our kids that we then don't expect of ourselves.
That's right. Now, the book is called 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. Peter, thank you so much. And if you want to get more information, or I think he has some other things on the website, go to www.peterbregman, BREGMAN.com. Peter, thank you so much. And I appreciate you taking out a good part of the time of your day and sharing with us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It was a fun conversation. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.